720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always a pleasure to be with you. And I am always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Well, lots to do on the program today. We're going to be checking in a little bit with Pam Jones. We've been talking to her all morning, but we're going to check in to get the latest from the March for Our Lives event happening at Union Park and starting to move here in just a little bit. So we're going to check in with Pam. And a little bit later, we're going to be talking with a business reporter from the LA Times about the latest on a very interesting move from the maker of Bratz dolls in the as Toys R Us is wrapping things up. There's an interesting move there in that story. But before we get to all that, we're joined by Mark Guarino, who is a contributing writer for the Washington Post, Cranes, The Guardian, many, many others. If you read news, you've definitely seen his byline somewhere. Anyway, he wrote recently at Cranes Chicago Business about traffic here in Chicago. It's a thing we're all frustrated with and many, many times. I know today it's on a lot of people's minds as roads are closed, things like that. But in looking at traffic data versus ride shares, very interesting patterns begin to emerge. Mark, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Gladly. I appreciate you taking out time of your for your Saturday to be with us. Well, so talk to us about, you wrote this very in-depth piece that's really, really very interesting, taking a look and kind of reconciling what ride shares are saying about, hey, this is about supplementing public transportation versus then actually looking at the data and what that means for our traffic and our roads.
Right. So this story looked at a lot of different studies, but we also worked directly with Transportation Institute at DePaul University. And we had them look at, basically cull a lot of data directly from the city of Chicago having to do with speeds. And they did a historic kind of timeline. And what they found was speeds in Chicago streets have actually been slowing, and particularly within the last year, 2016, 2017, when the data was last available, things slowed down about 2% citywide. Now, 2% may seem insignificant, but if you see it, you know, but any sort of, because it's such a tight window, it is actually pretty significant. And within the last couple of years, also coincided with the kind of ride of ride sharing or ride hailing. And so the story really tries to make a correlation between, the kind of, sort of gradual gridlock in city streets and the increase of this massive fleet of cars now that are everywhere.
And so how do we begin to reconcile that data when we have rideshare companies saying, oh, we're here to actually alleviate some of the traffic and supplement public transportation and help people have access to rides and have options versus when we're looking at this data?
Right. So they'll talk about that, but then the data kind of works against them because, you know, as again, like it's been a slowdown, not just on the city streets, but also city data shows that it's been a massive slowdown in expressways. At the same time, there's been a drop off of CTA ridership on buses and trains. And so the idea that it's pushing people to transit, it's just not coming through. I think there's been a 9% drop since 2012. Of ridership in the CTA, so that's been very problematic. At the same time, I think between 2015, 2017 in the story, something like 120,000 cars, ride-sharing cars, have taken to the streets. So you have over 100,000 cars now are being added to the streets just for the purpose of taking people someplace. And cabs have gone down. I mean, I think there's only about 4,000 cabs on the road. So 4,000 compared to 120,000 cars is obviously pretty dramatic.
Sure, sure. That's very dramatic.
Yeah.
You also note in the story the impact of idling, which is, I think, you know, at the top you mentioned speed.
Right, yeah.
Speed as being such an interesting factor. And I think when we think about traffic, we think volume. We don't think of speed and we don't think of stopping being a thing that's contributing to gridlock.
Right. That's one thing I learned from, you know, just the reporting is that, how this is all measured is actually through speed. So obviously the slower speeds means there's much more idling and much more just kind of sitting in traffic. And, there's the idling time. So the story looks at a study in the New York Central Business District and really found there that idling was a major contribution to all the gridlock there, which was, you know, in the middle of the day. So you have cars that are essentially empty except for the driver, just kind of poking around looking for rides. The idling is, so you can have almost 120,000 cars on the road in Chicago, but how many of them have passengers? I think that's a real significant question to look at, because many of them don't.
Right. And so do you get the sense that there are, you know, planned responses on the horizon, maybe from city planning, from public transportation, from taxi unions, anything like that to maybe address this? Or is there like peak gridlock still ahead for us?
Right. So the numbers are kind of going more towards the gridlock, right? So all the numbers are really kind of, that's the trend where, you know, we're just getting slower and slower every year on the streets. So that's where things are heading. In terms of the city response, the city has basically said that there's no plan to really address this issue. Where the activity really is coming from is from a lot of transportation nonprofits that want to have better planning for the streets. So you have the Active Transportation Institute and a few others that are really heavily engaged in the city and trying to lobby the city to say, look, you know, Chicago, especially on the north side, not overall, is getting much more dense. There's much more development. We're building high-rise condo buildings everywhere. Each of those condo buildings come with a car. So we're, you know, this is peaking towards sort of an unsustainable problem on the streets. You know, we're not building wider streets. There's no room to build wider streets. And so where is this all going? And so all the activity that you're talking about really is coming from that sector. The city really has not fully addressed this. And there's a lot of forces also from the taxi cab industry that really wants more of regulation kind of going down. And in my story, I talk about what other cities are trying to do or proposing that would help at least ease the burden on drivers.
Yeah. And what are some of those cities doing that seems to be effective?
Well, one thing that is being proposed is to have districts where you can have, or zones where if you're an Uber driver, you are forced to go to wait for rides. You're not going to be circling around neighborhoods contributing to the congestion in the streets. You're going to have to go to a certain zone where, in a way, we see this in airports already. So there's kind of, if you want an Uber in an airport, you have to go to a certain kind of yard where all the Uber cars are. And so in the loop and really heavily congested areas, there would be kind of those zones. And that would take those cars off of the streets, more or less, until they're needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one. Another one is congestion tolling. It's very unpopular. Essentially, it would be, you know, on the expressway or certain parts of the city where you're essentially charged for going in or contributing to the congestion if you choose to kind of go someplace that you don't necessarily need a car. It's, as you might imagine, it's very, very unpopular. It's probably why a lot of politicians don't want to touch it. But, you know, you are seeing, at least in New York City especially, there's really Mayor de Blasio really is kind of is pushing for some kind of solution here, but we're not necessarily seeing the same, you know, top priority of that issue in Chicago.
Yeah, and do we get a sense from the rideshare companies themselves that this is on their mind, or is this a too bad, people like our service?
Right. Yeah, no, it's definitely a PR disaster for them. So they're really kind of fighting against it, pushing it back. That they keep going back to the fact that we're actually helping. We are the most sustainable solution. We are, you know, helping people get out of their personal cars and get into, you know, shared cars and that kind of thing. So they're talking about the economic benefits of this economy in cities like Chicago. So they're really, really sticking to those messages and not really kind of seeing, you know, I think there does something needs to change in these cities, because I think in 5 years, things are going to look very different in terms of the congestion, and no one really kind of wants to go there yet.
Right.
Both on that, you know, their side and also the side of the the city halls across the country.
Right, indeed. Mark Guarino, thank you so much for being with us today and talking about this issue that's, I think, on our minds every time we travel anywhere, right?
That is for sure. That is for sure. You know, absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks so much. All right. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to check in with Pam Jones, who is at the March for Our Lives event at Union Park. And we're going to get the latest on that back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots to do on the program today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about the latest in the Toys R Us liquidation development. There's some interesting stuff going on there and that very big company. But with everything going on right now in the city, we've been looking at traffic, and especially around Union Park, as so much traffic is blocked off for the March for Our Lives rally. And let's check in with our very own Pam Jones, who is there at Union Park. Hi, Pam. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thank you for having me. We are finally kind of starting to move. Actually, you talked about the gridlock in traffic, and the marchers are facing a little bit of gridlock as well, trying to actually get out of Union Park. As John Williams was talking about earlier, the rally has pretty much ended, and the march has begun. I am not quite sure exactly what direction we're headed right now, though. I'm kind of just following at the tail of the crowd. Lots of marchers still here, holding signs. Librarians don't need silencers. We need sensible gun laws. That's one of the signs I'm walking behind right now. As tens of thousands of people attempt to leave Union Park and take to the streets of Chicago with their message of peace and nonviolence. They want to see it across the country. They want to see it in their own communities here in the Chicago area. Back to you.
And Pam, did you get the sense how many speakers were at the rally, and was it were you able to hear everybody, and like how was the crowd there?
This was a very organized event. They had a professional stage and sound system with audio visual. They had the big screens on either side of the stage so that those in the back could see and hear as well as those sitting in the front. There were dozens of speakers. I mean, I was going live at several different intervals, but we heard from students across the gamut, I mean, from different backgrounds, giving not only speeches, but also spoken word performances, their own creations, talking about how the violence has affected their lives. We heard from a couple of students who had their own personal stories about seeing gun violence kill someone they knew and loved, or just about one team talked about her brother getting shot in the head and killed. I mean, this is pretty emotional stuff. These teams have seen a lot, have experienced a lot. They don't want anybody else that they know to have to go through what they've gone through. And they really want to see some action. Some of the words today were action, not words. They don't want to just hear speakers anymore. They want to see change.
All right. Thanks so much, Pam Jones, there at Union Park. And I assume you're going to be heading east on Washington Boulevard with the march as it gets underway.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. All right. Well, we're going to take a break and get you to news. But again, we're going to keep an eye on everything going on with the March for Our Lives that is now moved from rally to march, and will be heading east right now on Washington Boulevard and then back to Union Park. So more on that as we continue. But let's take a break and go to news here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday. I know there's a whole lot going on today all over the place, not just in our city, but cities around, all over, everywhere. So we have been checking in with Pam Jones, our very own Pam Jones, to get updates from the march. And I'm sure we'll be doing that a little bit later. But in the meantime, there's lots of stuff going on social media. You can follow along if you're not there already. And if you are there, feel free to give us a call, 312-981-7200. We would love to hear from you. you. But right now we are joined by Jem Pletz, who is a business reporter from the LA Times, who has written about something that we have talked about on the show many times, and that is changing consumer behavior as we've moved more from in-person brick-and-mortar shopping to online shopping behavior. Many, many companies have really felt that and struggled with it. And one that we have talked about previously is Toys R Us. And as they're right now kind of at this 11th hour moment and starting liquidation sales and things like that and closing locations, suddenly someone has popped up and who's trying to change that narrative a little bit and perhaps even try to save Toys R Us a little bit. So joining us now is Jem Pletz. Welcome to the program, Jem.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. Okay, so talk us through the story, because it's a really this kind of came out of nowhere. It's this, the guy who created the Bratz dolls is suddenly making this bid to change the story with Toys R Us.
That's right. I mean, his name is Isaac Larian. He's the chief executive and owner of MGA Entertainment, which is one of the largest toy makers that isn't Hasbro or Mattel. And as you mentioned, his company makes the Bratz dolls, but also the little Tykes play equipment for kids and a lot of other things. And his problem is that 18 to 20% of his sales were going to Toys R Us. So their liquidation would be a big hit for him. He's also has a lot of sentimental reasons for wanting to try and save as many of the stores as he can, because he, you know, has fond memories of Toys R Us, taking his kids there and so forth. I mean, he thinks it's important that even in this day of online shopping, that there still be a big place for kids and parents to actually go and touch toys and take a look at them and so forth before buying them. So what he's doing, he's a billionaire by owning this company. And so what he's doing is he and a few investors are pledging $200 million of their own money and trying to raise an additional $800 million with a GoFundMe account from the public in order to buy at least, say, 400 of the 735 stores nationwide, Toys R Us stores, that the chain plans to liquidate.
And we think of GoFundMe and other crowdfunding sort of platforms as being for kind of clear beginning, middle, end, one-off projects, usually arts-related, something like that. Is there that inclination when we're talking about a large corporate entity, when we're talking about people who already have a lot of money, are people responding to that crowdfunding?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it's the most salient question, because if you think about it, I mean, obviously he's going to need a lot of either institutional money or wealthy individuals to donate to this effort, but that's all it would be. It would be a donation, and in fact, if you look at the GoFundMe page, it's not even tax deductible. So it's not like becoming an investor or a stockholder in a company. You don't have any particular voting rights. You don't have any equity in the returns of the company or the growth of the company. It's a strict donation. So I would say that's one of the reasons that this is somewhat of an uphill climb to try and raise that kind of money from the public in which they have no equity stake.
Right. As you note in the story that's at latimes.com, there's a bit of confidence here, right? I mean, here's someone with a lot of money who's noted that when he brought Bratz dolls to the market in around 2000, 2001, that there was, you know, a lot of people said, you know, you can't take on Mattel, you can't take on Barbie and all, you know, that is this icon in that space. You can't possibly do this. And yet he did. And so it seems like this guy has a lot of confidence that this is going to work.
Isaac Larian has a tremendous amount of confidence. He's a 63-year-old American rags-to-riches story. He came over here from Iran when he was a teenager and obviously made himself a fortune. But there are a lot of other ifs that he faces. I mean, for example, even if he was to raise the $1 billion that he needs or that he wants in order to buy, say, 400 or 500 of these stores, first of all, he has to get approval from the bankruptcy court where Toys R Us is reorganizing. That means all the creditors of Toys R Us would have to sign off on whatever deal they come up with. And assuming that happens, then he has to make sure he has a lot of things in place in order to keep running those stores. He has to have an executive management team. He has to negotiate hundreds of leases where all these stores are located. And he has to make sure that Toys R Us also is doing a very good job of migrating itself to the online area where, you know, it's competing head on with the likes of Amazon and Walmart and Target.
Right, right. And is there even time, though? So let's say he pulls this off. These kind of proceedings are notoriously, you know, tedious and drawn out, and there's so many steps and so many, you know, complex issues swirling around them. If he were to pull this off, is there any guarantee that it's even in time?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think there's enough time. He's put a deadline of May 28th on his GoFundMe effort. So that's one guidepost. Also, I don't think that the creditors of Toys R Us, I think they're the deadline for them to file their claims if they're governmental agencies like the IRS. I think they have until like May or June in order to do that. So presumably the bankruptcy proceedings would then drag on a bit more after May or June. But he set his own deadline of May 28th. So I think we'll know pretty well into next month. You can keep track, obviously, on a GoFundMe page of how it's doing, whether this effort is going to pay off.
Right, right. Well, it will be interesting to watch it now. Let's say that it does work out. May 28th comes. He gets his funding. What will be the immediate next steps for him and for Toys R Us?
Well, the next step would be for him to go to Toys R Us, and they would hash out some sort of an arrangement or some sort of a proposal for, say, buying X number of stores with the money he has. And if Toys R Us agrees, then they would take that to the bankruptcy court for the judge to give approval. But there again, like I mentioned earlier, that's then when the creditors get to come in and say, okay, well, would we be better off with this deal or with a straight liquidation of Toys R Us? In other words, if you're a creditor to Toys R Us, you know, how many cents on the dollar that you loan them are you going to get? And his plan might be $1 amount, a straight liquidation, which already has begun. I think the liquidation sales at Toys R Us started yesterday. Would the liquidation give them more money? Then it's up to the creditors, obviously, to figure that out and decide which one is best.
Right. Well, you know, I guess kudos for bold moves. I suppose it is unusual, and I don't think many people saw this coming. Were there any indications that was this as you know, for you who follows this kind of thing so closely in this area of industry, was this as much of a surprise, or was this really just something that kind of blindsided everybody?
I think for the public, obviously, it was a surprise. He had said as soon as Toys R Us announced that. You know, Toys R Us filed for bankruptcy last September, and they were planning to reorganize and come out of it as a going entity. But then their holiday sales over the Christmas period were just dismal, and they decided then after that they would liquidate. As soon as they made that decision, Larian, actually, I think it was Forbes or somebody, he told a reporter, he said, I'm thinking of actually maybe buying some of the company. That's when it first started. So it wasn't a complete surprise if you were paying attention, but I'm sure for most consumers out there, it is. And you can give him credit for, you know, certainly, you know, the effort. But again, like I said, he's staring at an 18-20% hole in his annual sales. And so from his point of view, it's not surprising to try and save it.
Right, right. Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Jim Peltz from LATimes.com. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a little break and come back here in just a bit. Plenty more to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to check in with Scott Catoon. He's got, I'm sure, lots of exciting things planned for the Startup Showcase today. But you know what? Before all of that, we still have plenty to talk about. One thing, Griffin, I don't know if this has been on your mind, but one thing that's been on my mind a lot is following the fascinating story that has been unfolding at Facebook, the Cambridge Analytica story. It's so interesting. And it's one of those, we've been saying for years, right, that if you don't know what the product is, you are, in fact, the product. And it's one of those things, we've been saying that for a long time, but I don't think we really realize the stakes of it.
Yeah. It's been a tough one for them. It's been a tough week for Facebook for sure.
Yeah. And so if you haven't been following, because I think people are, it was one of those stories, let me back up. It was one of those stories that came together so quickly and in such a complex way that all of a sudden people's heads were spinning to kind of like, wait, where did this come from? What is this?
Yeah, and it's a part of a swirl that already involves Facebook,
right,
with the targeted Russia,
exactly.
Russian ads, and it's a little difficult to parse how it's different from that, I think, for some people. So if you're not engaged completely with all of it.
If you're not on it
just
daily.
Seems like, okay, so it's another facet of that one story, it seems like. But it's actually kind of its own thing.
It's its own thing. It is It is indeed adding to the Facebook pile, but it is a separate thing. And so Cambridge Analytica is a data firm.
Yep.
And so I think for a minute, I think the narrative on social media, some people were going, wait, is it like Watergate? I'm like, no, this isn't the name of the scandal. That is, in fact, the name of a data firm that harvested a lot of data from a lot of users, about 50 million Facebook users around the time of the presidential campaign. So,
and many of those users did not have any knowledge of
idea
of
whatsoever.
Their...
yeah.
It came
right.
from, my understanding is correct, it came from a survey that some people took, but then, in which they allowed their data to be mined for some reason. They didn't really have a clear indication of what, but then it also, back at that time, Facebook hasn't allowed this for a couple of years, but at the time allowed apps to go into friends of theirs,
right.
connections of theirs on Facebook and use that data as well. They've since discontinued that, but at the time it was being allowed in 2014, 2015.
Right. And I think, you know, when we log in with Facebook, we're given a window that says, like, I hereby say that you can use that, you know, and I think it's so commonplace, we don't really read that so much anymore, you know, which is like, sure, you can. Yeah, it won't post on my behalf. Fine. I think that's usually the thing everyone's looking for. Is it going to post on my behalf? No. Great. Done. Easy. And I think that's what people look at. And there's so much more to it. And I think there's one narrative around it that's where people are like, well, I just don't share stuff that's that personal, so it doesn't know anything about me. It's not about that. It's not. It matters much less that it, say, necessarily knows your child's name. And it matters much more that it understands your behavior. And what will prompt you, what you will click on, what you will share. That's really where the stakes are quite high, because that, in fact, can influence the behavior of people connected to you.
Yeah.
When you have been moved emotionally to share something. So after a while, it will understand, okay, this person will usually share something about this topic. It's a pretty good bet if something is in his or her newsfeed, they will share it.
Right. Yeah. And there's a changing attitude towards privacy, I think.
Absolutely.
And that's what there's a New York Times story that just went up about 25 minutes ago. I imagine it'll be either in the print edition tomorrow but it's about changing attitudes on privacy that will lead to changing rules within Facebook and Google. They've announced that they're going to address this and that will result in some kind of change in their rules, but it's unclear what exactly those steps will be yet, I think, but and how that is potentially damaging to their business, because they are free programs and data, that's sort of like gold to them, I think.
Right. And, yeah. There was a piece, I'm pretty sure it was on Slate. I'll have to go back and check and tweet it out, but it was kind of hypothesizing the idea of Facebook letting you pay to opt out of your data sharing. And I was like, well, that's kind of ridiculous. And then only a certain protected group would be allowed, you know, if you could afford it, you could be. And I think at that point, right. It becomes even more of an exploitation, really.
And it's, well, and of course, in the past week, we've seen delete Facebook is the hashtag.
Yep.
And a lot of people, I guess, have, although I don't know what kind of dent that's actually made yet.
I know. It will be interesting to see. I mean, we saw a couple of high-profile ones, right? Elon Musk took Tesla and SpaceX off, and I think a whole bunch of people went, I don't care. I wasn't connected to them anyway. I think a lot of people were like, I'm not worried about that guy. You know?
That just seems like a Silicon Valley ego power
struggle. Totally,
scrotum,
didn't it? I know.
Which I'm here for. That's kind of
right.
fun.
Yeah.
But it's
right.
I do
yeah.
like that. I imagine them running into each other at a cocktail party or something and being very awkward.
Zuckerberg, Musk, like but, staring at each other. Like
I'm guessing they
like
didn't
Seinfeld
like
Seinfeld and Newman
already. Yeah, for real.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Probably not. So I just think this is an interesting story. I was talking about this the other day on the air, and it was about two books I recommend on this topic. One is called The End of Privacy by B.J. Mendelsohn, and you can download that. I've interviewed him before and really had a really thoughtful conversation. And here's an author who's kind of taken the like, privacy is an illusion, so I'm just going to like hide in plain sight. In fact, went so far as giving out his phone number on the air and saying, you can text me and I'll send you this bonus content.
And I asked, you know, do people abuse that? And he was like, no, not really. I mean, once in a while, but not any more than you know, not as much as you think. The other book is called Terms of Service by Jacob Silverman. That book is a couple of years old, and I think I've mentioned it on the program also. But I have also interviewed him and really has some interesting things to say, particularly around the area of influencing behavior through the data that is collected around us. And it's not just about targeting ads. And I think that's where that conversation ends a lot. It's like, oh, well, so what? Ads are targeted to me. It's about influencing behavior and emotionally manipulating us, right? It's that. He also takes a look at that book in kind of points to an easy way to see what we're kind of missing and what we're kind of turning our perhaps willful blind eye to is to look at how the tech giants have fared in European courts. Because there's a lot of issues that have surfaced in high courts in Europe that have not surfaced here. And you'll quickly kind of see very different attitudes, very different financial ties, things like that, that's very telling and very interesting.
They're more restricted by the government.
Absolutely.
There,
yeah.
Whereas here you see it being more of a consumer uprising, which is happening in all kinds of industries that people want to go straight to business. Well, we've seen this with guns. In hopes of changing policy instead of going to the government because you see more reaction more quickly there.
Right.
But I think it's totally true, and you sort of touched on it talking about one of those books, but what's happening with our privacy hasn't changed. It's all about perception.
Yeah.
Facebook used to be very open with the fact that they could influence voter decisions and voting behavior. They pitched that to political candidates to say, we have such a role in people's lives that this is the best place to advertise. We can absolutely change voter behavior. And they were open about that a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And you can kind of sense on their side, people being like, well, nothing's changed except you're just mad about it now.
Right.
I think is true, but it's just, we're kind of thinking more about it now. People, instead of just tacitly accepting it, they're starting to think and see the ramifications a little more. So
I mean, I think it was kind of the Wild West for a little bit, right? And there was novelty attached to it. And now that we've realized, well, this is a major part of our lives. This has political implication. This has social issue implication. This is a big deal. Revolutions have started around the world and been able to happen because of social media and because we all have a smartphone. The role of the bystander is different, and that changes so many things. So I think as we've begun to accept that, we're like, wait a minute, the novelty is wearing off. We're like, hang on a second. Happier note, perhaps, or lighter note anyway. And that is, I don't know about you, Griffin, but I have been super frustrated the last couple of months because Instagram just keeps showing you the same thing over and over. Like, it won't refresh.
Yeah.
They changed their algorithm a while back, and it was immediately I hated it because it was like, I've seen that post 300 times. I don't need to see it again. They've heard us. They listen to the show, obviously, and they've heard my complaints. But in response to user feedback, they say that they're going to be shifting, and there's going to be a new post button so you can see. You can actually, what a novelty, see the new things you don't have to see.
More chronological, yeah.
As much as I like seeing my friend's new dog over and over, eventually I want to see other stuff too. I don't want to miss it. So there's that. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to check in with Scott Catoon, find out what's happening on the Startup Showcase back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.